This World.
Minus 8.5 minutes.
Nuclear weapons are one of the greatest threats to humanity. Every year there's a meeting to assess the risk of global catastrophe and set the doomsday clock. The hands are currently at 90 seconds to midnight, the closest they've ever been. With unique access to the experts who set the clock.
This is a very dangerous time. Leaders are not acting responsibly.
I want to find out what's brought us from Oppenheimer's invention to this point.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Nuclear weapons, nuclear terrorism, nuclear proliferation. Right now, it's just going in the wrong direction.
I'm ordering the strategic nuclear forces on special alert.
In Britain, our own weapons are on high alert.
There's always one out there at 15 minutes notice to fire.
Somewhere out there.
And American nukes could soon be back on British soil.
We get Trump in there next time, and he may press the button because he's got a bigger button than Putin, then we are a target.
The question is, where will the doomsday clock be set for 2024?
Now.
Nuclear Armageddon. How close are we? Streets of residential houses from the air, then reporter Jane Corbyn's on her laptop at the living room table.
This is one unseasonally bleak scene which has profoundly moved many people during 1982.
Well, here's the Green and Peace Camp, 40 years ago now.
Their peaceful protest against the sighting of cruise missiles here is into its second winter. Despite
when I was a young reporter in the 80s, the nuclear threat was ever present. People talked about the threat of nuclear war between Russia, then the Soviet Union, and America all the time, and then it went away, and it really receded into the background, except I kept on investigating.
Is the Islamic Republic actively seeking to get the means to make a nuclear bomb?
It's often rogue nations, rogue actors, as they were called, trying to get weapons.
North Korea's tested a nuclear bomb, believed to be 10 times more destructive than Hiroshima.
That's huge. So what, the whole village comes in here, that's the idea. In the last few years, we've had a whole host of global uncertainties, and now it seems that the nuclear threat is really back on the agenda again.
The story of the atomic threat begins almost 80 years ago in 1945.
We have seen that before. Film showing the bursting of the first atom bomb, the experimental one, in New Mexico. It was dropped from a steel tower and filmed from about 6 miles away. Afterwards, cameramen and reporters put on special canvas boots as a precaution against picking up dangerous particles left in the circle of devastation. And as for the steel tower from which the bomb had been dropped, this is all that was left of it.
Sprawling desert and shrubland from the air.
I've come to New Mexico in America.
It's all pretty barren and empty out here. I can see why it would be an area to test weapons.
The small town of Los Alamos was the birthplace of the atomic bomb.
A street sign for Oppenheimer Drive. Then Jane walks up to statues of Groves and Oppenheimer.
It feels so peaceful here. It's extraordinary to think that this is where it all started. This is where the first atomic bomb was built and developed by Robert Oppenheimer and his team. The so-called father of the atomic bomb.
Well, we had a moment where it looked like the chain reaction from an atomic device might never stop.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want for theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
The recent Hollywood blockbuster, Oppenheimer, told the story of the Manhattan Project and the development of the first atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
This modest little log cabin right on the end is the house where Oppenheimer himself lived during those months that he was working on the Manhattan Project.
I've been given privileged access to the house by curator Sherry Trottier.
This is the room why the Oppenheimers chose this house.
So have you had more interest in Oppenheimer and the house since the movie came out?
Definitely. As people, as you saw, peeking through the windows, there's a great curiosity about where did this man live? This was Oppenheimer's study.
Look, typewriter.
Yes.
Yeah, opened by the censor as well, because it was also secret.
Yes, everybody's mail coming and going was censored.
So Oppenheimer would have meetings in here with other scientists. This would be a room in which a huge amount went on.
People were invited here for dinner, and Oppie served his very strong martinis. There are stories where people literally had a very interesting time trying to leave and walk upright.
Professor Andrew Futter, author of The Politics of Nuclear Weapons.
The basics of nuclear weapons hasn't really changed since the first bombs were developed in the 1940s. They are still based either on fission, which is the splitting of atoms to release power, or they are based on fusion, which is the fusing together of atoms to create power. What we think of as a nuclear weapon is actually a number of different components. So there is a warhead, which is essentially the bit that goes bang. That contains the fissile material, whether it's uranium or plutonium. The warhead has to be transported in a certain way, and it's what we call a delivery system. So it may be, this warhead may be in a bomb that's dropped from an aircraft. It may be on top of a missile of all sorts of different ranges, or indeed it could be in a whole host of different ways as well.
Grainy black and white archive film from an aircraft shows the white mushroom cloud of an explosion below.
That's the atomic bomb exploding at Nagasaki. All of you who see this picture can judge for yourselves the extent of the menace to civilization of this new weapon.
In 1945, the United States dropped their new weapon on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hundreds of thousands were killed. It changed the face of warfare.
Airmen rushing to board an aircraft.
America had ignited a nuclear arms race. 4 years later, Russia began testing atomic weapons.
Soviet footage, the explosion occurred at an altitude of 380 meters.
Followed by the UK in 1952.
After the first blinding flash, Dr. Penny turns round with a smile of satisfaction to view colossal spectacle.
In the 60s, France tested.
The film record has been heavily censored by the French authorities, but this picture is impressive evidence of the bomb.
Followed by China. Those who now possessed nuclear weapons had the ultimate means to deter an attack, giving them enormous power. Soon, the nuclear club grew. India detonated its first weapon in 1974. Then Pakistan developed the bomb in the 90s. It's widely believed Israel has nuclear weapons, though it's never confirmed this. In 2006, North Korea carried out its first nuclear test.
A newsreader says it was a perfect success.
The story of nuclear warhead proliferation is numbers went up exponentially. The total number of warheads that have been built is probably well over 100,000. But what we've seen over the last three decades is a gradual slowing down, a gradual reduction. However, there are probably in the region of 13,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, in the nine states, most of these in the US and Russia. The two bombs that were dropped in August 1945 killed somewhere in the realm of 200,000 people. Most modern nuclear weapons today are more powerful, have more explosive yield. In the UK case, probably somewhere in the region of 6 to 7 times as powerful. And many of the other states have warheads that are more powerful still. So even just a handful of those could probably destroy the UK.
black and white footage of the aftermath.
The explosions at Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the radiation sickness that followed showed the true horrors of nuclear weapons. Oppenheimer was haunted by his creation.
1965.
We knew the world would not be the same. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
The Manhattan Project scientists who created the bomb felt compelled to warn the public. They came up with the idea of the doomsday clock. To visualize how close we are to destroying our world.
The mushroom was becoming an acceptable fungus in man's garden. A group of scientists tried to waken the general public from this apathy and founded a periodical in which they tried to explain the social and political consequences of atomic power. Its cover design became a clock approaching midnight. As the time for atomic scientists and the world ran out, its hands neared the end of time.
When it was first set in 1947, the hands stood at 7 minutes to midnight. They've moved 25 times back and forth since then. In the 1990s, to the furthest point, 17 minutes away, when the Soviet Union broke up.
Vladimirovich Putin.
By 2017, with Putin and Trump in power, and North Korea's Kim Jong-un, the hands went forward again to 2.5 minutes. Today, on top of the nuclear concerns, climate change and threats from new technologies like AI are part of the assessment. In 2023, the hands moved the closest they'd ever been to midnight, just 90 seconds away.
A sheet is removed to reveal the clock hands display.
I've come to Chicago, where the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is based.
An empty meeting room with a long U-shaped table and multiple seats.
In this room, scientists and experts will meet to deliberate where to set the clock for 2024.
North Korea has threatened to detonate a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific.
President Putin has ordered Russia's strategic nuclear forces to be placed on
the president alert. Warning the risk of nuclear Armageddon has not been this high since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Jane enters a modern three-story office building. She greets a middle-aged woman with blonde hair and glasses.
The Bulletin's president is Rachel Bronson.
Nice to meet you. Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
So this is the Bulletin?
This is the Bulletin.
Bulletin of Atomic Scientists covers?
Yeah, they go back 75 plus years. This is the original Doomsday Clock.
So that was the very first iteration of the clock?
That's it, right there. It was created by an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a metaphor about how close we are to destroying humanity with our own technologies, with our own making. This was the late 40s, countdowns, mm-hmm. clocks, rockets, missiles. This was a dangerous time. Yeah, and they saw the potential of a global arms race. They really believed that if you could educate the public would put pressure on leaders, and leaders would have to keep us safe.
Why did you make the decision in 2023 to move that clock to 90 seconds to midnight?
It was largely around the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which our Science and Security Board deemed as one of the most dangerous times in history. Why? First of all, the US and Russia control 90% of the nuclear weapons on this planet. Now, a nuclear power state using nuclear weapons as a tactic, as a terrorism, psychological terrorism, but also potentially as a tactic, they were threatening to use nuclear weapons.
You're talking President Putin, Russia.
That's right. And so that was the first time in a very long time that we could remember such threats and them being bandied about so casually. And so it was a very, very scary time. And the likelihood of misperceptions and accidents were so high that largely for that reason, they moved the hands of the doomsday clock closer to midnight.
Whoa!
The Russian invasion of Ukraine was a war President Putin expected to win quickly. That didn't happen. Ukraine fought back with weapons supplied by Britain and other NATO allies. Just days into the conflict, President Putin made a threat that shocked the world.
February 2022.
Top officials of leading NATO countries are making aggressive statements about our country. Therefore, I'm ordering the Minister of Defense and the Chief of the General Staff to put the Strategic Nuclear Forces on special alert.
Putin's warning to the world not to join the fight alongside Ukraine revived fears of nuclear war not seen since the 1960s.
Trams in a city.
I've come to Geneva in Switzerland, a city associated for many decades with efforts to bring peace, and now home to one of the main United Nations offices. Pavel Podvig is a Russian expert on weapons of mass destruction and Russia's nuclear forces. For a decade, he was involved in setting the doomsday clock.
The Russian president made it very clear that nuclear weapons are on the table. He said very specifically that if someone would intervene, then they will see the consequences they've never seen in their lives, which was a direct reference to nuclear weapons.
How shocked were you that President Putin would say that at that time?
That was pretty shocking, I would say. At that point, we didn't know what that would look like. I wouldn't say we've never seen before, because if we go back to like 62 and the Cuban crisis, we may have seen things of that order of magnitude. But imagine this happening in the 21st century. That was definitely a shock.
And President Putin, why did he do this? And what does it tell us about him and how far he might be prepared to go?
Well, this is exactly what nuclear weapons are there for, to make sure that you have a certain freedom of action. And at that time, apparently the Russian president believed that by making these statements, he could deter the West from intervening on the side of Ukraine, which was a correct calculation. This is how deterrence works.
But do you think there's a danger that if he was backed into a corner, if there was an existential threat to Russia, that Putin could use nuclear weapons?
Well, technically, yes. The weapons are there.
Merci beaucoup, President. Merci, Vladimir.
So the only way Russia can use nuclear weapons in this conflict is to use it in what I would call a strategic sense, like, or in Hiroshima and Nagasaki sense, too. Shock the opponent into surrender, Ukraine in this case. The reaction of the international community to just the idea of nuclear threats was very strongly, very negative. People didn't like it, and they did force Russia to lower the rhetoric, and it was clear that bringing nuclear weapons again, even as a threat, will definitely not bring Russia any friends.
This isn't the first time the world has held its breath over the prospect of nuclear war between Russia and America.
A sea of planes that on a moment's notice can be in the air to avenge any communist strike.
In 1962, Russian missiles in Cuba raised tensions to boiling point.
It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States.
At the 11th hour, the crisis was averted. But that close call sparked the need for better global cooperation on nuclear weapons.
Archive Film Insurance for Peace.
In London, representatives of three nations sign an agreement to halt the spread of nuclear weapons, taking out an insurance policy, so to speak, against a worldwide nuclear holocaust.
In 1968, the Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed. It's still in force today. It was meant to restrict the nuclear weapons club to just five: the US, Russia, Britain, France, and China. Other countries agreed to only develop civilian programs like nuclear power plants.
Under the NPT, most countries agree not to develop or seek nuclear weapons, and they accept safeguards by the International Atomic Energy Agency to verify that all of their nuclear activities are strictly peaceful, that no nuclear facilities or nuclear materials are being used for weapons purposes. It basically provides stability in the international system, in the global nuclear order.
The treaty limited the number of countries that developed nuclear weapons. But the 70s and early 80s saw a massive arms race between the two major players, America and Russia. During the Cold War, they ramped up the number of nuclear warheads to over 70,000 between them. The fear was they could set off an all-out nuclear war with devastating consequences.
The enemy realizes that an attack on the United States would likely mean committing national suicide. Nobody wins a nuclear war because both sides are sure to suffer terrible damage.
During the Cold War years, we were constantly at loggerheads. We had a lot going on to try to get our hands around the threat of nuclear weapons and the threat of nuclear holocaust, because it is an existential threat to humanity. It was something both the Soviets and we, later the Russians, felt we just had to keep working on.
1985.
Then the world changed. A new Russian leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, came to power.
The world had waited 6 years for this moment, and yet Mr. Gorbachev's first words were easygoing and natural. Dobry den, he says. Good morning.
Gorbachev and President Ronald Reagan met at a historic summit. Shortly after, the two superpowers signed the START Treaty, a commitment to reduce the number of nuclear weapons. The Cold War was over, and a new era of arms control began.
That was really an incredibly promising time, because the Cold War had ended, and we had this opportunity to rethink the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. policy, and to greatly reduce. And nuclear weapons were greatly reduced over that time by a total of about 80%.
In 2010, U.S. President Obama signed a second START treaty with Russian President Medvedev to reduce their stockpiles still further.
I was responsible for negotiating the new START treaty. It causes us to limit our deployments of nuclear warheads to 1,550 warheads each. It was a bit of a golden moment, I would say, in the U.S.-Russian relationship, and we were lucky to be able to get the new START treaty negotiated during that period.
Medvedev was president, but the real power in the Kremlin was the then Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin.
I know for a fact that behind the scenes, Vladimir Putin was trying to throw a wrench in the works. It was, I think, difficult sometimes to get things across the finish line in Moscow. But in that way, it was a typical arms control negotiation, each side pushing for its own national interests. We got it finished, and it did enter into force.
Military men stand as Putin walks into an operations room. Then a tank moving along frosty ground.
Today, President Putin's invasion of Ukraine and his nuclear threats have brought cooperation with America to a halt.
Military chiefs told Russia's leader the task of delivering a massive nuclear strike by strategic offensive forces had been rehearsed.
The new START treaty runs out in 2026. At present, there are no negotiations to extend it. That could spell the end of over 30 years of agreement between the two major nuclear players on limiting their weapons.
We are no longer conducting on-site inspections or really exchanging information that provides both sides a great deal of predictability about nuclear weapons systems on the other side. So to me, it's a tragic moment for nuclear arms control.
Putin hasn't just challenged America, but all European countries in NATO, protected under the US nuclear umbrella. Russians have made direct threats to use nuclear weapons against Britain, one of the founding members of NATO.
A Russian TV talk show where a seated man says, "We may use them, but definitely not in Ukraine. We still have to live there. But if we turn the British Isles into a Martian desert in 3 minutes flat, they won't respond."
That's put the UK's nuclear readiness on alert. Britain's nuclear deterrent is housed in the west of Scotland.
So this is Fast Lane. This is the hub, the absolute hub of Britain's nuclear deterrent. And you know that because of the security fence, which is really extensive right round the base, heavily electrified, and barbed wire right along the top of it.
Since the height of the Cold War, naval base Clyde on the banks of Gare Lough has been at the heart of the UK's nuclear policy.
That's the guard post, the entrance to the base. The only way you can really see the base is by going up high.
She turns onto a winding woodland road, which reveals a view of the compound from above.
Look down here and see the pens, the submarine pens down below me. I can see that there is one of the submarines on base in the dock right now.
Since the mid-1990s, the UK has relied on just one means of delivery for its nuclear weapons, continuous at-sea deterrent. These are warheads placed on top of Trident ballistic missiles, which are housed inside Vanguard submarines. The UK is unique in relying on just this one particular system.
She pulls into a lay-by where she meets a man who's standing by his car.
Here he is.
Fergal Dalton is a retired lieutenant commander who served on HMS Victorious as chief weapons engineer.
Hello.
Morning, Jane.
Nice to meet you, Fergal.
And you.
What a lovely morning.
Yeah, welcome to Fast Lane.
Shall we go and have a look?
Yeah. That's the ship lift, that big building you're seeing there. We can take submarines out of the water, do engineering work. Further along to the right, it's all the engineering support. Nuclear submarines are very complicated systems, systems within systems.
So how does Britain's nuclear deterrent actually work?
Well, there's four submarines, four Vanguard-class submarines, and one of them is always deployed. One's ready to take over, one's doing maintenance, one's maybe in refit. But there's always one out there at 15 minutes notice to fire.
Somewhere out there?
Somewhere out there.
A submarine just above the surface, then crew on board sitting at the controls.
Do the crew know where they're going?
The crew absolutely do not know where they're going. The captain and the navigator will know where they're going.
Does the Prime Minister know where they are?
No, nobody back on land knows where they are. Nobody in the military chain of command on land knows where the submarine is. Nobody in Britain knows where it is. The Prime Minister doesn't know. And the whole point being that if the Prime Minister had a gun literally put to his head and was asked, "Where is your nuclear weapon arsenal?" He wouldn't be able to answer the question.
And what is the command structure between government, between those submarines, wherever they are out at sea? How does it work?
That starts with the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister would give that instruction to the military, Chief of Defence Staff. When the message would come in on board to the submarine, myself as the Weapons Engineer Officer and the Executive Officer would both go to the communications department and pick up the message. And we would hold it aloft, holding it each side, so the whole crew could see that we have this message. And then we would go and encrypt it with the commanding officer and the strategic missile officer. And we would check that that is a properly authenticated, valid message.
Because there's a heck of a lot at stake.
Yes. The whole point of the nuclear deterrent is that it's never actually fired. People say, oh, you know, it's a weapon system that would never be used. It's been used at the moment. As we speak at the moment, there is a nuclear deterrent out there. The Vladimir Putins of this world know that it's out there, and they know that it's credible and that we could use it if needs be.
If the government was taken out by a nuclear strike, how would the submarine, the commander, the crew know what to do, where to go, who to target?
If we determine that there is no British government left, there is the letter of last resort, which is a letter from the Prime Minister to the commanding officer.
And where is that letter?
That letter is in the authentication safe in the control room of the submarine. Every time there's a new Prime Minister, one of the first things he or she does is sit down and writes that letter to the commanding officer of the nuclear deterrent.
Fergal is one of a handful of people who have fired a Trident missile with a dummy warhead from one of the subs.
Buttons are pressed on a control panel. A missile blasts up through water, then amid clouds of dense smoke, launches into the sky like a space rocket.
We're demonstrating to our military commanders that we can safely operate and deploy nuclear weapons. We're also demonstrating to our political bosses that we have this ability, this capability. And there's also an element of demonstrating to the potentially hostile nations of the world that Britain has this capability. So I guess when I pulled the trigger and the missile was launched, it was a real sense of achievement, a sense of pride. I think any thoughts you have about it, you do beforehand. How I reasoned that in my own mind was that, you know, Britain is a democratic country. We have elections. There are political parties who stand on a mandate for deploying and operating nuclear weapons, and they win those elections. And we will take our orders from our political bosses.
The Vanguard-class submarine, launched in 1993, was supposed to have a lifespan of 25 years. The oldest is now entering its 31st year of operation. A new class of four dreadnought submarines are currently under construction at a potential cost of £40 billion.
The process to replace the current fleet of submarines actually began well over a decade ago. Building submarines takes an awful long time. This is a multi-decade project. Slowly, one by one, the new submarines will replace the current fleet so that by the mid-2030s, we will have a new fleet of nuclear-armed submarines that will then probably be deployed until the 2060s.
For decades, Britain has been reducing its warhead stockpile to around 225. We asked the Ministry of Defence to explain their nuclear strategy. They turned down our request for an on-camera interview. But the UK's policy is in publicly available documents from 2021.
Well, this is interesting. It says, following the government's most recent defence review, they announced that the cap on the UK's nuclear stockpile would actually increase to no more than 260 warheads. And given the current global security environment, they say, they'd be extending their policy of deliberate ambiguity and no longer making public any operational details.
The Big Ben clock.
So Britain has increased the cap on its nuclear arsenal by 35 warheads, and there's even greater secrecy around them. Sir Lawrence Freedman is a professor of war studies at King's College London.
Good to see you. Let's sit down.
Why do you think the UK government has recently become less transparent about the nuclear stockpile?
I think because when they did discuss it in 21, I think they felt it was overinterpreted. People were making more of it than it deserved. It becomes an issue every time you look at replacing one generation with the next because it looks expensive. There's, you know, billions and billions of pounds involved. But that's a question of government priorities rather than sort of the basic strategic principle of whether you're a nuclear weapon power or not.
Has it allowed Britain to, as it were, punch above its weight over the years?
I think that claim was made, and it was probably true in the late 50s and early 60s, where the UK did play quite an important part in arms control because it was a nuclear power. I don't think it has a major impact now. They're still essentially on the same idea that we're staying in the nuclear business, but we're not trying to compete with the big boys. We're not trying to be a superpower. We just want to make sure that we have a credible deterrent, as we've been through with the war in Ukraine, where Russians quite regularly make threats to the United Kingdom. It's a degree of reassurance to be able to say, have you forgotten something? That, you know, you may wish to do all these terrible things to us, but we could do terrible things back in return.
Is there an argument that what happened with Putin's threats over Ukraine, which was essentially outrage across the world, has put them out of bounds? The whole morality of nuclear weapons has been shown up to be a real problem for states.
The problem is that nuclear deterrence worked for Putin. I don't think he thinks nuclear deterrence has been a failure for him, whatever the moral outrage caused by his invasion of Ukraine, because the Biden administration and other NATO governments said, we understand that if we get directly involved fighting side by side with the Ukrainians, that risks a nuclear war. And they didn't. And they made that clear right at the start. The lesson of Ukraine is that deterrence can work.
The British government is not alone in seeing the value of increasing their nuclear deterrent program.
Chinese soldiers marching in a military display.
According to the Pentagon, China has significantly expanded its nuclear stockpile in the last year to 500 operational warheads. And it's hoping to double that to 1,000 in the next 6 years. In Russia, President Putin has recently revealed there will be two new nuclear submarines added to the Russian fleet. In New Mexico, the United States is also modernizing and expanding its nuclear arsenal.
I'm looking down on the old Los Alamos laboratories, and in the foreground is the massive new Los Alamos complex, where thousands of scientists are still working today on nuclear weapons research. And over there to the south is the old Trinity test range, where that first atomic weapon was tested, and it is still a test range for the US military today.
Los Alamos is still one of the jewels in the crown of the US nuclear program, building on the history of Oppenheimer and his team. The labs here design and develop the main element, the explosive nuclear warhead.
A Sinery's Los Alamos project main gate.
Thomas Mason is the director of the Los Alamos lab. Due to the secrecy of the work, we are meeting in the historic part of the old town.
Would you say there was a renewed effort to develop here at the labs, develop those nuclear weapons, because of the concerns that we've seen globally, potentially, about the use of such things, which we all thought was long in the distant past?
And so right now we're in the midst of a modernization that was really conceived of, you know, before the significant change in the geopolitical environment. Of course, what's happened since then is both in Europe with Russia and its unprovoked invasion of Ukraine, and some of the events in Asia with China rapidly expanding its arsenal, there is now a different geopolitical environment. We're now, for the first time since the 80s, having to look at a new set of military requirements driven by the actions in other countries. And in fact, we've started work here on the W-93, which will be the first new warhead introduced into the stockpile since the 80s.
The Russians and the Chinese might look at what's happening here in the States, more money being spent on developing these kind of weapons, and say, well, this is ramping it all up. Why wouldn't we do the same?
Well, in fact, they have been. For decades, the U.S. policy was to not do anything towards developing new weapons, to not do anything that might be seen as provocative. And as it turned out, while we sort of pursued that policy of not developing new systems, Russia went and hadn't modernized their systems. In fact, they're largely complete with that modernization, have introduced a lot of new weapons. And China is in the midst of what has been characterized as strategic breakout. So, I think it was a good effort to kind of demonstrate restraint, but it appears not to have been successful.
It's a balance, isn't it? You've got to strike between modernizing, moving ahead, having that arsenal, and not causing the problem, not inflaming the situation.
I think that balance, that challenge of the balance, has been with us since 1945, and it's with us today, and I think it's going to be with us for quite some time into the future.
In Chicago, the scientists are meeting to decide where to set the doomsday clock for 2024. The war in Ukraine is entering its third year. There's new conflict in the Middle East, and many nuclear arsenals around the world are growing. Their discussions may well be some of the most difficult since the clock started ticking.
The doomsday clock discussions are some of the most interesting that I participate in. There's really a full exchange of views. At various times, I've been on both sides of this, arguing there's reasons for optimism and hope. I've also, at other times, pointed out how the risks have increased significantly.
I think when we come into the room, it's a heavy feeling. It's a sobering feeling. There's a lot of responsibility. We know a lot of people are going to pay a lot of attention to what we say. As always, we know there'll be a lot of criticism, but that it will be used by leaders at the highest of levels and by kids writing book reports. Everybody uses the clock.
What's the general feeling amongst the board as to where we're at now?
This is a very dangerous time. We have moved from a period where nuclear weapons were considered unusable and a nuclear war unwinnable. We're seeming to move into a period of time where we're not so sure every major country, UK included, is investing in their nuclear arsenal.
But nevertheless, no nuclear weapon has been used for 70, 80 years. People would say, isn't this scaremongering? But there's no way we're moving towards that again.
And they'd be wrong. People would be wrong to say there's no way we're moving towards that again. In fact, when you look at operational plans from the Russians, they militarily practice as if nuclear weapons are usable.
The scientists and delegates sit around the meeting room table, some typing on laptops, others speaking. A sign reads Conference Room F, then in a wooded area, the new Los Alamos complex.
With the major nuclear powers investing billions, global tensions are increasing. So newer players could see these weapons as the ultimate guarantee of preserving their status, even their very existence. Like North Korea. Leader Kim Jong-un regularly showcases their military might on state TV. This clip from 2022 shows the testing of a long-range missile capable of carrying a nuclear warhead.
Kim, wearing sunglasses and a leather jacket, consults his watch and two military officers do the same. Then he gives a nod.
So far, the immediate threat is to their neighbours, South Korea and Japan. But Kim Jong-un's also made a big show with his recent test of a missile capable of hitting America.
Jane drives along a residential street, then walks up to a house and greets a slim, white-haired man at the door.
I'm meeting scientist Sig Hecker, who's travelled the world visiting nuclear programs, including those of Russia and North Korea.
Sig.
Yes,
Jane.
Jane, pleasure to meet you.
And you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Come on in.
He's also been involved in setting the doomsday clock for many years.
Oh, what a beautiful house you've got.
Thank you.
You see many of the Russian,
yeah,
the Matryoshka dolls.
So because why have you got these dolls?
So why did I get those? Because I've been in Russia 57 times.
Wow.
Since 1992. Okay. So I've worked so close with the Russians.
57 times?
57 times.
You beat me.
Yeah. Oh, how many times have you?
Oh, maybe 15 or 20.
Oh, really?
But not 57.
So I was just...
Sigs recently returned from another visit to the Far East.
I've been to North Korea 7 times. So I've been to their nuclear facilities. I've talked to their diplomats. People sometimes look at crazy behavior, you know, by the North Koreans. Would they launch a missile or do a nuclear test? I see all much more of sort of a calculated progression.
So what do they have and what could they do with it?
So, of course, North Korea being what it is, it's pretty difficult to look inside. So my best estimate at this point, they have been able to build up a pretty good stockpile of highly enriched uranium, over 1,000 kilograms by now. And if they turn all of that into weapons, they may have 50 to 60 weapons today.
That's really significant, isn't it?
That's really significant. What makes it even worse is what kind of weapons do they have? They've done 6 nuclear tests. First one in 2006 didn't work so well. The last one so far in 2017, that worked too well. So because of that, today, my general assessment is they can put a nuclear warhead on their short and medium range missiles and deliver them. So in other words, all of South Korea and most of Japan is within reach of a North Korean nuclear-tipped missile. That's really bad. You know, we should have never let them get there, but that's where they are. They have demonstrated the missile or rocket capabilities to reach all of the United States, but they still haven't done enough nuclear tests to make the warhead small enough to put into those missiles and survive essentially the ride, including the re-entry. And so they're not yet there, but that's what they're currently focused on because they want to be able to threaten the United States.
They're not there yet, but they could be.
They will be there eventually because I've watched them. And every time when somebody said North Korea can't do this, a few years later, they did it. As I think about it, the big concern is nuclear weapons use. Okay, who would nuke the United States? Well, you know, possibly Russia, they have the capability. Possibly China, they've been improving that capability. Who else? North Korea, that's it. So there are only 3 countries that can threaten the United States with nuclear weapons. And this little bitty North Korea of 25 million people is one of those.
So another player in this whole field is Iran. Iran wants nuclear weapons. Where's it got to?
Iran today has everything in place. So should they decide that they're going to go ahead and enrich the uranium fully up to weapons grade, they could build a bomb in 6 months to a year time frame.
That must be a concern.
That is a great concern because that in the Middle East, particularly as we see what's happening today, is real. That's very different than North Korea. But Iran, it's a sea of instability in the whole Middle East, and so that's a great concern. But they don't have the nuclear weapons and haven't decided to go there at this point.
Some governments see the benefits of having nuclear weapons. But their existence has always proved controversial with the public.
An anti-nuclear demonstration in 1967.
Since the birth of the atomic bomb, there's been protest. In the 1980s, millions took to the streets to voice their opposition to nuclear weapons. In Britain, it's not just been protest against our own warheads, but against having American ones based here too.
1983, women being dragged away by police as they sing.
The Greenham Peace Camp was home to thousands of women who fought to get the weapons removed.
Women protesters were doing their best to tear down the airfield's perimeter fence with their bare hands.
If we get together, we can actually force the government to turn back the decision that NATO made on sighting cruise missiles in Europe.
After a long battle, they succeeded. Since 2008, there have been no American nuclear weapons in the UK. But that may be coming to an end. Pentagon budget documents suggest the UK will now be one of six NATO countries where US special weapons will be stationed. It could well be here, RAF Lakenheath in Suffolk. US fighter planes that will be capable of dropping such weapons are already based here. And there are now plans by the US Air Force to increase accommodation for a potential nuclear mission.
At the base, a sign on a chain-link fence reads, "No US nukes in Britain, CND." Then protesters in white boiler suits.
It's small scale so far, but there's protest here by the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
Sophie, hi, I'm Jane.
Hi,
I've
got cold hands.
No wonder being up there. What's the idea of today? What's this about?
This is all about putting a spotlight on Lakenheath. We've got overwhelming evidence that the US are planning to site nuclear bombs here. The government will neither confirm nor deny, but it's absolutely clear. And we know that we've got public opinion on our side. You know, nearly 60% of the population do not want to have US nuclear bombs sited in Britain. This base is surrounded by secrecy. They don't want people to know what's going on, because people do know. They're up in arms about it.
I'm here protesting today because people need to know about the threat of nuclear weapons being stored at this site or anywhere, really.
So tell me about the 80s. Were you at Greenham Common?
We were part of a women-only demonstration, and we came from all over the country, women who were just desperate to get rid of these terrible weapons that were going to be put on our soil. That's why I can't believe we're doing this again.
We shouldn't have weapons of mass destruction anywhere in the world, but when they're on your turf, it's extra incumbent on you to do something about it.
We've got nothing to do with this base. It's totally under United States control. If we get Trump in there next time, and he may press the button because he's got a bigger button than Putin, then we are a target.
The British government and the American government would say we need this because Putin has threatened to use nuclear weapons in the context of the invasion of Ukraine.
The idea that everybody has to nuke up, it's false. It's not working. Do you know what I mean? If you look at it, like, nuclear weapons haven't kept the peace. We're now in this very, very dangerous situation where, you know, the doomsday clock, the atomic scientists who put that together, they're now saying the world is in a far more dangerous situation precisely because of what's happening in Ukraine. So we feel that, like, just adding more nuclear bombs to that situation is not going to make it safer. So that's why we're going to continue protesting here, because we don't want these nuclear weapons coming here. We want to encourage our government to say, nope, we're not going to accept them.
There's now a global movement for a total ban on these weapons. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons has introduced a groundbreaking treaty. In 2017, they won the Nobel Peace Prize. Daniel Hoekstra is the deputy director.
Hi there.
Hello, I'm Jane.
I'm Daniel. Welcome to ICAM.
Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you as well.
So we've got a lot of photographs here.
We do. Yeah, this is the photos from the historic days in Oslo in 2017 when we were fortunate enough to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. So this is the original medal that we received. You can hold it if you'd like.
Was it surprising to get this?
Incredibly surprising. We were just three people in the office at that time working at ICANN. We had no expectation of winning. So when I picked up the phone and answered the call, I thought it was a prank initially.
What is the treaty about?
The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is the first treaty among governments that comprehensively prohibits nuclear weapons and all activities involved in nuclear weapons, from use to testing to modernization. But it also contains other important provisions that are aimed at helping the communities that were impacted by the nuclear weapons test, over 2,000 of which took place since 1945 as well.
So how many nations have signed up and how many are still trying to get on board?
Well, of course, we're trying to get all governments to join the treaty, but currently we have 69 governments that have ratified since the treaty entered into force in 2021.
But there's 190-some countries in the world, so you're a long way to go.
We are a long way to go. We're under no illusions about how difficult this is going to be. I mean, the nuclear weapon states are steadfastly against this treaty.
What about Britain? Because they haven't signed up. We're a nuclear weapon state and not going to sign that treaty.
The UK is one of the countries that is very much opposed to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and is perhaps even pressuring other countries to not join the treaty. The UK always talks about nuclear weapons as its deterrent. It never refers to them as what they are, which is weapons of mass destruction as well, which put its own citizens at risk.
But it's naive, isn't it, to think that weapons states, nuclear weapons states, would sign up to getting rid of them? It's the source of their power.
Yeah, nuclear disarmament activists are often accused of being naive. But I think the real naivety comes when assuming that you can have this weapon in the world and that it will never be used, when all the 9 nuclear weapon states are emphasizing constantly that they are ready to use them. So basically, we're trusting the 9 individuals who are in control of those nuclear arsenals to never launch a nuclear weapon.
When asked for comment, the Ministry of Defence said, the UK is committed to the long-term goal of a world without nuclear weapons, in line with our obligations under the NPT. We firmly believe the best way to achieve this is through gradual multilateral disarmament.
Looking up at towering skyscrapers in Chicago,
the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists will soon reveal where the hands of the doomsday clock will now be set.
Discussions taking place in the meeting room.
Now, in 2023, we judged that the risks of catastrophe were increasing and unacceptably high, and so we set the clock to 90 seconds, closer to midnight. And I would judge that the risks of catastrophe still remain unacceptably high.
Nuclear weapons, nuclear terrorism, nuclear proliferation. Right now, it's just going in the wrong direction.
I think there is a very good argument for setting it back. We've seen that the opposition to the idea of threatening nuclear weapons is very strong, and it is universal. And I think that must be reflected. The clock is a very powerful instrument to send that message.
We are investing across the globe as if the nuclear weapons are usable for a very long time. And these are not the weapons that we need for the 21st century. People are scared. It doesn't feel normal out there. It feels dangerous. And in some ways, we can say it is. You're not crazy. We should think it's scary and dangerous. Leaders are not acting responsibly.
A sign reading bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
For another gripping and terrifying soap opera, a host of power players open up at the end of that red button. Putin versus the West on BBC iPlayer.